tell the audience about how you got started in real estate.
Welcome to the Masters in Real Estate podcast with your host, Tanner Webster.
At a college, fixing and flipping homes.
Okay.
And then I didn't have any money, right? So
yeah,
I had to figure out a way to get money. And so I met some investors, and that's where I started borrowing investor money.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, actually, just started here.
Yeah.
So yeah, just keep
sure. Going. Yeah. So that's started with raising investor money for just my own deals. And so started fixing and flipping homes right out of college. Right away realized after meeting with a lot of construction workers who weren't standing upright, missing fingers and broken wrists or carpal tunnel.
That's my family you're talking
that's
about.
That's like something I wanted to, I was like, well, maybe there's got a better way to do this. And ran into more investors who were fixing and flipping homes. And this is back in 1993. And back then there wasn't a lot of subprime money that sort of evolved into 2008. So it's pretty much private capital is the way to go if you knew where to get those types of funds. So I had a handful of investors that I borrowed money from. And
just like friends and family?
No, actually people I just met in the investment world.
Where was this? What part of it?
This is in Washington State.
Yeah.
I was going to college up there, so it was sort of... I got into it because I was first demoing houses for a guy I was renting a house from. And then I decided I wanted to get a fixing and flipping my house, I mean, on my own. And at that point, there wasn't, like I said, I didn't have any money. So I met some investors. And
how'd you learn how to do this?
That's a good question, too. When I was demoing homes, the guy that I worked with, that's what he did. And so I kind of watched him do it. I'm like, I could do this.
Right? It's like a story of my career.
Yeah, that was it's always being young and feeling like you can do anything.
Yeah.
Hubris at a young age works pretty good for you. It gets a little scary as you get older, but...
It's more forgivable when you're...
It is. You can make mistakes. You can start over again.
It's just a young hustler.
But it's just me, and you don't have a family and other things to worry about, right?
Yeah. My dog doesn't care about my family.
Exactly. I can sleep on a futon on the ground. It's fine.
Yeah. It's a simple life.
Yeah.
Okay. So you were fixing and flipping homes, and then mid-90s, late-90s?
Well, so early on, some other people were... fixing filthy homes that I knew, and they didn't have money either. They're asking what to do, and I had investors wanting to give me more money to fix a flip home. So I said, well, how can I make a living doing this? And so I started to broker, essentially brokering money, private placing, investing with people I knew and taking a spread. And then deals got a little larger, and I realized I had to put more than one investor in a deal. And in Washington, and in most states, that's considered securities, fractionalizing things. And
yeah.
Early on, I realized that would be an issue. And so Washington had an exemption to that federal code. It was an interstate offering. So you had a specific license for that, but you had to raise money in state and do deals in state.
So like a series license, or was it a...
It was a... All you needed, an advisory license or a Series 63, but outside of that, it was just a bunch of paperwork. It was basically looked like a general prospectus and a specific offering they'd have to put together, and these investors that participate, and essentially if things go wrong, this is how it's going to be handled.
This is how they're going to sue you?
And you're going to lose everything at the same time.
Yeah,
so,
that's great.
So come on in and invest. And I didn't really know how to do that, so I picked up a book on collateralized mortgage-backed securities. It was like very thick.
Yep.
Kind of got through it, kind of got the sense of what needed to be done, and then I studied two of the companies in the area that were doing that. And so, yeah, I got licensed, formed a company, started doing that.
Did you stop fixing and flipping homes, or was that kind of...
I would do that a little bit on the side, but the nice thing is when you're... And I recommend to a lot of people who are fixing and flipping homes, it's always good to have another consistent trade. Living flip to flip,
it sucks.
It's a dangerous place, too, because you end up making bad decisions.
Yeah.
Oh, this one will just work because I need it.
Yeah.
And then you spend 6 months running in place doing nothing.
Yeah, and just hoping that people are refreshing Zillow.
Right. Well, also back then there was no Zillow.
Yeah, so that's even worse.
But yeah, no, it was real estate investing now is fascinating. And it's grown a lot. So I started doing that, and then I ended up getting out of the business because I got married, and I'm originally from all of Hawaii, so I went back to Hawaii, so my business to my partner, and then got into banking for 10 years, so I didn't know what I was going to do over there. And at the time, subprime market was starting to pick up. There was more and more capital available. I got a really good taste for wealth management. And I was kind of doing this placing private individuals' money anyway. So it was a natural progression to just do some of that. And business banking is fascinating for anybody interested in anything having to do with business because so I was in corporate and wealth management, you just learn about so many different businesses and you get to see everything they do and how they do it. And you get to see why some succeed and why some don't. And so it's really fascinating in that regard. And private wealth management, understanding the difference between creating wealth and preserving wealth and different investment vehicles for that. And came to realize that I really enjoyed private lending and I wanted to get back into that. But at the time, subprime was exploding. And subprime was really where you could get free money.
It was free money.
It was like free money, easy to get.
Yeah.
So private capital didn't exist. It almost disappeared during that time. But then when 2008 happened, capital dried up and subprime market blew up and everything kind of blew up. Private capital became a thing again. And that's when I decided to come back to Washington because I knew there'd be a great opportunity to do that. And I did the same thing. I had a bunch of investors and private family people I worked with that wanted me to place their money. And I was begging people to take the money. I mean, banks were just letting things go for nothing. And it was a fascinating time, but nobody was so hard to get people to borrow the money.
Yeah.
And, so we would start buying the properties and then call them up, hey, you want to buy it from us? We'll lend you the money. And that started going. And then I think what ended up happening is the investment community overall, and I would even say Wall Street, was seeing the returns that some of these private capital groups were making. And so I saw this industry reform again and mature. You had these small advisory firms that would help you set up your RIG-D placements and would help you do servicing, investor management. More funds grew out of it. They started lending money because at the time when we were doing this, we were probably getting about a 24% rate of return on a yearly basis on the money.
So just like, what kind of like points in APR?
So 12 to 14 and anywhere from 10 to 12 points.
10 to 12 points?
Per year, yeah.
Wow.
So that obviously is going to attract
a
lot of attention.
Yeah, that's great.
It did. So problem is, as more money flows in and these vehicles flow in, price of capital starts coming down.
Yeah.
Specifically the points. It's harder to get points out of it, right?
Yeah. Do you have any issue with like, is it usury or whatever, like paid loans?
Some states have usury issues that you need to be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
So Washington doesn't. Some states do. So if they do, you do need to be cognizant of that. Yeah, so Washington is a great place to do it. You also don't need to be licensed. A lot of states don't need to be licensed to do private money, as long as you're not touching owner-occupied homes.
Yep.
Yeah. And some states you do, so you got to be careful of that.
Okay. So you were doing that for a little bit, and then how'd you end up to what you're doing today?
So I met Eric Corliss.
Friend of the show. We love Eric.
Yeah. So I met Eric probably 15 years ago. We were talking private money. We became friends. And over the 15 years, we just became friends. We hang out every quarter or so and have lunch. And he saw what I was doing. I saw what his family is doing and how his family is progressing. And then about 3 years ago, they came into a liquidity event that prompted them to look for good investments that I think were core to what they do. And they asked me if I'd be interested in coming to build a fund for them, do the private lending for them.
So you jump ship. And something interesting about what you guys do is you're balance sheet lenders. You're not syndicating. You're kind of the opposite of me. Like I have to take in all sorts of outside capital to do these deals. You guys just kind of stroke a check from your checkbook. And I'm curious to how that kind of affects some of the decision-making specifically compared to the way you used to do loans. Are you more aggressive, less aggressive? How does that kind of change your thought process?
That's a good question. I have always been on the conservative side because I've always acted as fiduciary to somebody else's funds. There's a bit of a be cautious to say complete misalignment. There's a little bit of misalignment with some of these funds that get paid to manage and bring in money because they get paid for the money that they manage. And so you're trying to get as much money as you can. If you make mistakes, you still get money on the money you're managing.
The asset management fees are the same.
So from a fiduciary standpoint, I think I'm more aligned. I've always been more aligned with my investors because it's their money. And so I've all sort of been paid on how well we do, essentially, right? Not just booking loans.
Yeah.
So I think the Corliss family appreciated that. I also was a fiduciary in my private banking years for many years. So I've always had this natural desire or personality to protect other people's money. And so we're conservatives in what we do. There are definitely private capital lenders and funds that are backed by investors, even levered by banks, that are more aggressive than we are. And I can't, in good faith and comfort, chase those types of underwriting criteria. So we hold pretty tight to ours. And so my decisions in the way I underwrite haven't changed much. Just in my private wealth managed days, when you're creating wealth, you take risk. That's what you do to create wealth. But at a certain point, after you've achieved a certain level of wealth, then it's about preservation. So the objective is take as little risk as possible and get the highest return. And one way is to find tax strategies to maximize that, because that's a free return on your money. And then other ones are like secured lending, where the principal is pretty much protected. So on a good day, we get a great yield. On a bad day, we don't lose any principal. But since we've been in inception, we've achieved our yields that we wanted to achieve, and we haven't lost any principal. So, and even during this really challenging 2 years, which I would say have been significantly challenging for a lot of lenders.
You mentioned kind of your underwriting criteria. I want to dig into that. Let's say I bring you an industrial deal or something like that. What are you kind of looking for on that?
Good question. I also have a hard time answering that question because most funds have very clear criteria.
Yeah.
So here's the box, fit in it. We don't really have a box. We're very rational about our approach and logical about our approach, and that we're very value-based, right? So we focus more on conservative loan value. So in an industrial deal, probably not want to be more than 65-70% as is. If there's a component that we're going to add value to rehab it, then I don't want to be 65-75% as completed. There's this wonderful formula in the middle that dictates, are you putting enough, money into it to bring it to the proper value to exit? But I would consider our underwriting very simplified. You'll see a lot of other lenders, especially that are investor-based or especially bank-based, that have all sorts of interesting criteria like credit scores and cash reserves and all this experience.
How much do you value on that? Like, are you pulling borrowers' credits?
No. So my experience, because I lived through 2008, the nicest people who have the best intentions, bad things happen to good people. And often the market is something you can't control. And when that happens, it doesn't matter how much money you have. It doesn't matter what the credit score is. It doesn't matter anything. They want to pick that back. They just can't, right? So learning from those lessons and being very principle-oriented and preserving principle, if they get a credit score, it's great. If they got a lot of cash can go. Credit scores can dive. I'm missing one payment. They're really more collateral focus and exit focus. Like, do we have a good, clear exit plan? And do we have good equity in the project? Which gives a lot of people opportunities, when you don't have to fit those other criteria.
So I've done a couple hard money loans, kind of similar to what you've talked about. And something I always run into is someone will say, it's a 105% loan to cost, but it's a 50% loan to value on the backside. I mean, if I brought you a deal that was like, I need 500 grand, I can sell it tomorrow for 1.5 million. What goes through your head on that? Like, I could just be making this up. I guess, how do you answer that question? It's a very high LTC, but a very low LTV loan. How do you look at that aspect?
So LTC, normally you're adding value, like you're building something. So if you're buying something that has great value, there's a lot of...
This is a very nuanced question.
Yeah, there's lots of in-betweens, right? Like, are you looking at it? So first thing I look at is, okay, what's the real value of this thing, right? Because most lenders, if you're buying something $1 million, you spend 3 years finding the best piece of property for $1 million. It's worth $1 million. And then you go to a lender and he goes, well, I'll give you 60% of the loan to value when you pay for it,
yeah,
whichever is lower, which yeah, means that whole 3 years to find a great property, you're still bringing $400,000, right?
Yep.
We'll actually look at the real value. So it's a more of a older school approach. But if the deal has merit and makes sense, I'm not going to stick you in a box. If I'm a really value-based lender, the value's there, I'll look at potentially 90%, 100% loan to value on it, on the acquisition, right? Then you're going to put a bunch of money into it and you're going to see what it's going to be worth. That's like a whole, that's a second phase, right? But like we did a land deal recently where a client had an option to buy it, and the option was tied up for like 6 years, and they finally had execute on it and the value went up almost 100%. I didn't realize that when I did the deal, because I looked at it from is this a good underwritten deal, right?
Yeah.
And after we did the deal and the broker advertised them on their website, 105% loan to value on acquisition. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right, I did. But typically, we don't see those types of deals, but we used to, and that's how I got started, right? I didn't have that kind of money put down, so I'd go to an investor and say, hey, I went down to the auditor's office and I looked up all these distressed opportunities. I found, something before it went to foreclosure. I approached the buyer. I got it tied up. It's probably worth 200. I can pick it for 100. Will you lend me 100? And they go, yeah, I'll lose you 100 for you.
That's I think that's the difference between what you guys do compared to these syndicated debt funds. Like, they really do have a box that they have to plug that into, and they could never do, this 105% LTC loan as long as it's, even if it is a good deal,
Yeah, that's where you've seen the market mature. So the market is heavily matured now, where a lot of the underwriting is the same. It really is. And the reason why it's the same is they're out raising investor money. And if you're going to raise investor money, you don't want yours to look any more aggressive than the next. So they all look the same. And then at the same time, when you're going to the bank, the bank are lending these funds, they want certain underwriting share, so they're going to close their layers, they have their investor layer. By the time the product comes out at the end, it's a box.
The same, yeah. It's the same.
And
it's the same loan.
It's fine if you have some cash and you fit in the box. Why pay the extra? But in my experience, I've always been a relationship lender where, when I was looking for deals and you spend that much time finding a deal, last thing I want to talk to the same guy. I want him to know what I do. I want him to have some ability to make a decision. And I don't want to be in a box, because if things don't go right or things work out very well, I want to be able to talk to somebody. And a lot of times those box lenders, when things don't go well,
I'll see you later.
You get one more extra, you cut off, and you just kind of processed out,
So I think we started to talk about that a little bit, but rates for you guys are obviously higher than a credit union or a bank. Maybe not as much now,
right.
But back 2-3 years, or probably 3-4 years ago, it was 10-12-14% APR or 4-5% APR. Now that gap is kind of tightened a lot, you have a much more compelling pitch as far as value goes. But what else is the value prop to these borrowers, rather than just, hey, I'm just a regular guy instead of a big bank? What is the value prop to borrowers that you can bring that a bank can't?
That's interesting. So that's generally dictated by what banks won't do. So I recommend people now who are looking for money actually use brokers. Brokers didn't exist a whole lot 2008 to 2015, just because there was a lot of money. We were coming out of a bad situation. But it became capital became highly available. And then we had this interest rate impact that fractured the market. I mean, it fractured it. There's all sorts of money in all different ways out there right now. And I recommend people use brokers, find a good broker, because our difference changes. And it's constantly changing. My role at the company is to identify where those credit gaps are, so we can pivot to fill them, to help the gears turn, right? Like, for example, when this credit, when rates went up, the immediate thing that happened is private lenders got buckled because their lenders basically, you can't lend on land anywhere, you can't do certain things. So money started to move, and in that process created a big gap. One of the gaps was horizontal development on plats. So there's all this money now that shifted. Banks are, we're comfortable doing vertical construction, and we'll let you do that. And so there's all this money like now on the edge of this gear that can't turn because there's no lots, no finished lots, right? And some lenders got into situations where they're doing lot loans and they were using their vertical to take the lots out. Well, if you're caught in a big land loan for 25 lots and you got a bunch of money tied up in there and you want to go vertical, but your vertical line will only let you do 10 at a time, you can't take out your land loan because you got 25 lots. So we saw an opportunity to fill that gap. So that's what we did. We went and helped these, literally went to another private lender, took out their 25 lots into our portfolio, let them reach in, take 15 out, start building 15, and then the gears all started to turn again, right? So it's a complicated question, just say, oh, it's just this or it's just that. It's really where credit gaps are is where we always generally try to find opportunities.
I've also found that the best deals are the ones that the banks don't want to do anything with because they have the most hair on them, they have the most problems to solve, and the banks would much rather lend a 50% LTC.
Well, they got a super yeah. tight box, right?
Yeah.
So we generally do opportunistic purchase. I'm just got to close quickly. I had an appraisal. Perfect example where we're going to go a high loan to value, but it's worth a lot. So I mean, the loan to value is low because the value is high. Yeah. Even though they're bringing a lot of money in, banks are more focused on cash flow. We might have an exit. So we know it's not going to cash flow. We know the client can't cash flow. We know that they have an exit 12 months. We need to build an interest reserve in to meet that exit. So we're packaging the deal for this hopeful exit, right? It's very different. And that's why I really love what I do as a balance sheet lender, because we can look at, we see a lot of really interesting deals.
And who would you say you're the best kind of fit for? Like, would you say that you can do all product types in all locations? Like, could you build? I'm imagining because of the interest rate, you might not be the best fit for, vertical construction apartment complex that takes 5 years. Or would you say that you are for another reason?
No, I think, we're definitely a 12 to 18 month type lender, I think. Some of our strengths, or should I say our strength, is that we're small, nimble, and we're creative and flexible. But that also makes us picky. I try to find the best word to use, but we can be picky. Right?
Yeah.
We don't need to get money out. We don't need to lend this money. We're not driven by investor demands or anything. We're driven by what's a good deal. So, we don't particularly like hotels, hospitality. We don't like restaurants. We're not ready to be contrarian to chase office just yet. If it's on our backyard, like Washington, we'll do ground up construction, but we like multifamily mainly. We may look at some commercial industrial, but we haven't done a lot of that. Like to do multifamily garden style because Corliss 1892 is, a family of Corliss management, and that's our assets under management company, which builds on multifamily. So we know if there's a problem, we can handle those problems. But I've looked at some podium deals, which I'm not really comfortable with, because as a fiduciary lender, I have to assume the worst. Prepare for the best, and I want the deal to be underwritten to the best, and I want to give our client the opportunity to achieve their goals, but I have to assume the worst. And the worst is it doesn't get purchased to foreclosure, and I have to deal with it, right? So we have to look at it in a way that it makes sense. So we can get creative, but we also look at the deal much differently.
So on that note, what happens when deals go south? Like, how do you look at that situation? Are you, immediately hitting the foreclose button, or how does that work?
That depends too. Typically, it depends on our college sponsor or client's willingness to continue to participate. So if I'm doing ground-up construction with a client, it's going over budget, he's doing his best, it's gone long, now we can't make payments, but he's out there doing his best, I'll continue to finish with it. I won't generally charge late fees or accelerated interest in the payments because he's still contributing. He's still trying, right? And so in that way, I feel like we're doing, I'm in the car with him. It's getting a little early. We're getting, you're going sideways, but you know, the minute he jumps out, then I gotta, you know, then it becomes foreclosure and I gotta go, you know, do the charge our accelerated, charge our fees. Do we gotta do a foreclosure? So I try to finish with the client. I don't want to take it back. If the client is unresponsive, then I have no choice. I have to foreclose, yeah. Right? And so we just go through the normal process of foreclosure, and we prefer against personal foreclosure. But if not, we're fully prepared to take it back and manage it to completion.
That's one of the ways I learned how to do real estate is there's a local hard money lender here. And whenever he had to foreclose on people, it was my job because he's
go tidy it up.
Yeah, he was too rich to do anything, so it was my job.
Yeah, I had a friend of mine whose son is going to college, and he heard what I did, and he thought it was interesting, and that's what he asked. Like, so how do you? And this is probably just like you. How do you get into doing something like that? And
yeah,
I had to stop for a second because I don't learn anything about that in college. I think some of the best fiduciary lenders are also have swung a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
So they know what they're getting themselves into. Like when I go look at a house or look at a budget, I can get a good idea if I think this is on or off.
Yeah. Right? Cabinets might be a little more than $3,000.
Yeah. Well, that kitchen, you did have $2,500. What are you going to do with that kitchen?
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Stuff like that. Or I'll go look at a house and I'll see, you know, an ungrounded outlet, or I'll see that it was built in 1921 and I see three different areas where the roof line's a little goofy, or I'll see lath and plaster, I'll see galvanized piping, or I'll see knob and tube wire. You get a sense for what this is about to turn into.
Because yeah,
fix and flips are challenging in that you go through two phases, right? First is the disease phase, like what's wrong with it? What do I need to get it to the point where I can put the drywall and put it back together?
Yeah.
So nice thing about ground up construction is there's none of that, right? But you have to be sure from then construction that you understand your permitting process and other things like that.
Yeah.
But it's almost easier than fix flips.
On the ground up construction note, what type of, do you need fully entitled projects? What type of entitlement risk are you willing to take?
So if somebody brings me a lot, I immediately want to know that that a sewer can be put on it or a septic. It can attach to sewer, it can be septic. Because if I can't do one of those, or the sewer's down the street around the corner, it's going to cost $500,000, that's a problem, right?
Yeah, it hurts your land value.
Yeah, so normally you want the sewer out front, so we'll take that into consideration. Okay, how far am I from a sewer? Because generally water's right behind it, that's not the issue, it's the sewer, right, getting into the street.
Yep.
Or a septic, so I want to know that that can perk, meaning it can get a septic on it,
because
it's a beautiful piece of land, but if it can't perk and you can't get and I can't put a house on it.
Yep.
So I like to know those are the two primary things. So if it's on septic, I want to know if there's water, because sometimes you need a well, sometimes you can tap. So as long as I can have waste and water and utilities aren't way up the hill, I've seen those too. Hey, I got a beautiful piece of property on top of the hill. It's great view. I'm like,
where's the access?
Where's the tower, right?
Yeah.
I drove up here. There's no way a truck's getting up here.
Yeah.
How are you going to get materials? So it's just the basic stuff like that. But as long as it's a build, you know, you can show that it's buildable, then I can work with you. And our ideal situation is where client's got a piece of free and clear dirt and they want to build on it, and I'll put up the loan for it. And often I can extract enough cash off the property to help front load their first draw so they can build, reimburse. And in the end, if they've done it properly, they'll get their reimbursement back. And so they're back into cash flow. And if they made some hiccups, then they can use some of that to solve it. And that's surely a good recipe to get us to an end.
So on the topic of home building, I feel like home builders are probably the best fit for someone like you. Out of all of the sponsors, it's the brain damage of just doing the loan application fees for like a credit union or a bank. I think that's worth it in itself to just not do that. So let's say I'm like a mid-sized home builder. I've been using friends and family money. Now I want to really scale my business. What can you guys offer them?
Those are actually some of our best clients. Right now, the cost of bank money or maybe 3 or 4 points off. So if you're building something and worrying about 3 or 4 points, probably
Probably immediate.
Probably want to build it. Yeah. And so we can provide immediate money without the headaches, the banks are requiring. We're not that much more expensive anymore. And honestly, we're probably easier to work with because we have a development background. We understand things go over and take too long. And if they do, we're not going to generally shut you off.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we've become very helpful to a lot of regional builders in our area, small builders in our area.
And do you guys have any other criteria that you're looking at deals? Like, are you saying we're in on these states and we're out on these states, or is it anywhere in the country someone can call you and get a loan?
Yeah, we're definitely in on Washington and we're in on Utah. I'm from Hawaii, so we'll do stuff in Hawaii. But again, we're picky. So would I look at something in Texas? I might. If somebody called me and they said, hey, I got a project just finished at the bank. I got a construction loan. I can't get my permanent financing because I haven't quite stabilized it. I need something for a year, but it's done. It's risk-free. I don't got to go hire a crew to finish it somewhere in Texas that I don't know anything about. I'd look at something like that, right? If it's something where I got to do a horizontal development or get to the dirt, then it's probably going to be, we'll probably stick with our regions, which is Washington and Utah.
Cool.
Hawaii is tough too, just because the land to build ratio is different than other states. Cost you $750,000 for a piece of land and you build a $350,000 home when it should kind of be the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have a hard time. I'm comfortable with that, but it's hard to get our investment committee behind this and troops.
How does the investment committee work? Is it just, I like asking loaded questions. Like, if I send you over a deal, is it just you and Eric getting together and say like yes or no?
Pretty close.
Yeah.
It's actually Eric, Steve, Bill, and I. Bill is our advisor on the development side. He's been a family friend and he's very integral to the company regarding to making decisions. He's got bank experience and builder experience. And so, we meet every Wednesday. Try to package some deals to meet every Wednesday. We talk about them and we say yes or no. And then I get to close it. I mean, I can pull what I call shotgun meetings together if something comes up and we got to deal with something quickly, but I try to keep us on that if possible.
And during the IC, it's just, here's this deal. Here's the sponsor. I like it. I don't like it for XYZ. Is there any common themes about why you say no to deals?
Location sometimes is an issue. A lot of lenders, again, especially if they're funds and they're bank based, have certain regions they need to stay within, certain per capita, or we'll do those, but we get a little nervous about those. Also, collateral is really important. For example, I'm looking at a deal that came in. It's a duplex. But it's kind of a converted house duplex. It's older. So it's been rehabbed just to be able to rent.
The problem old landlord I have, special.
Right. The problem I have with that is, what's my exit, right? If I just take that back, what am I going to do with it? Who's my market? Who am I going to sell to? Will a retail bank look at it as a duplex? Is it properly converted duplex, or is it an SFR that's been divided? So the person who owns it, I'm getting great cash flow. I'm like, well, that's great. But
it's illegal.
Right. Yeah. And so what is it really worth? Right. Oh, well, it's worth this.
It's a 5 cap.
Exactly. So 5 cap duplex, 1929 home. Those are hard for me to get behind. I'd like to. I really like, but that's not something we would want to take back and own. And if I had to take it back, what do I need to do to it? And I can tell you, if I went to go inspect it, I would see new electrical, new plumbing, got to reconvert it back. So I'd have to look at that like, what is this worth as a fixed single family rehab? What's the value of that? What's it going to cost to bring it to that? To me, that's what it's worth today.
Yep.
And then I'll give you a discount on that. So those don't work very well.
Yep.
But I think, you have DSCR loans out there that kind of fill that gap. Then I'll look at some of those and I don't compete with them.
So you guys are almost exclusively first position loans, right? Have you ever looked at mezzanine or second positions?
We'll look at seconds.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's dig into that.
Those are really unique situations.
So we're uncovering all the unique stuff here, so it's great. Is that just like a home run of a deal or like a like maybe rescue capital? Like, how would you look at that?
Yeah. So one of our strengths is actually part of one of our greatest weaknesses. One of our strengths is that we're a legacy family. So we look at everything for the long run. It's not what my quarter returns are, and we got to make decisions and we got to get out of stuff. We're going to bank. If I have to take something back, we can put it on the balance sheet for 10, 20 years.
Right.
So in deals like that, if the client has a real need, I have to underwrite that as if, okay, what will happen if we took this thing back?
Right.
And that's when seconds sometimes work, right? Because you got an apartment building that's got a $3 million first out of $4.5 million, and they got a hiccup and they need $500,000 on a second thing's worth $7 million. So you had 60% combined loan to value and they need a $500,000 position. I have to assume if that goes bad, I have to take out the first. If I collect fees and interest on $500,000, but I got to now put $3 million into it, my yield goes
down,
way down, right?
Yeah.
And so I have to be prepared for the worst. And so we'll only do those in unique circumstances, which means it has to be a property that we, although we don't underwrite to own because we don't want, we are plenty busy on our own development side.
Yep.
That's how I have to look at those. But it also allows me to reach a little bit, because if I had to own it at 75 cents on the dollar, is that okay? Right. If I have to take all this foreclosure and get that, you know, that fits, then that's okay. But those are the types of conversations that I really want to have a really clear communication with a client. Like, you know what you're doing, right? You know that if this goes wrong, you know, you could lose this property. And, you know, the great thing about real estate investors and real estate developers, they're very risk tolerant. They take risks. You know, you're all in. It's like poker in every hand. You're all in.
Yep.
So you go in and they're comfortable. I don't like taking properties back. I was an investor too.
It sucks. Yeah.
It sucks for everybody. It's just a no win, right?
Yeah.
And so I just want to be, but also I realize if I don't, somebody else might help this person. And it's not that it's a bad deal. I just don't want to be that person, but I have that conversation with them.
Yep.
Sincerely. Like, we're doing this. You get it. You know, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't pretend. Yeah.
And if someone wants to get a loan from you, where's the best place to reach out?
Email, call me.
We'll put it in the show notes. We'll put your cell phone number.
Yeah, no, I don't mind. Or like right now, I'm primarily the one that does all that around any business development. And so I like to talk to people. I love to talk about deals. I mean, that's how I think how we met.
Yeah.
We called and we just started chatting. I like to share what I know. I like my clients to be well-educated, like know what their options are. And if I'm not the best option, I don't want them to do business and want to help them get to the best place.
Cool. Yeah. Well, this has been great. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely. It's been fun.